Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas. This is Out of Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 446 for December 21st of 2018, Automation, Electrification, and Other Highlights of 2018. Watch Out of Line After Hours live at outofline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Out of Line in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
Out of Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
All right, Out of Line After Hours. We are getting going as of this instant.
We are.
Hello, Gary.
How are you? So here we have the holiday theme. We have the decorations that Carmen and Katie came up with. You know, and I'm looking at this lovely tablecloth here, and it seems as though Santa drives a VW Beetle.
Is that a beetle?
Doesn't that sort of look like a beetle?
Yeah, I don't know. To me, it looks like some old Renault.
All right.
You know, we had right at work, I'm missing our ugly sweater contest right now at work, and this looks like it would be a contender.
In fact, if we made a cut in that, you could put it over and have an ugly poncho.
Poncho, yeah.
Christmas. And that voice, everybody, for those who are only listening to the audio version, is Drew Winter from Ward's Auto. Great having you here, Drew.
Great to be here, John.
Yeah. But we got to let everyone know our special guest for the day is Bill Kazira, the president and CEO of TI Automotive. And Bill, it's great to have you on the show.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here again. Thank you very much.
You've been in the industry a long time, right?
Yes.
I mean, even before you became this big shot executive that you are right now, you started almost as a little kid, right?
Yeah. So I tell people I'm enjoying my fifth century now in the auto industry because I started when I was 9 years old working for my father, who had a wood dye model and pattern shop at the age of 9 years old. And he had me sweeping up his mill room for 25 cents an hour, which I dragged out as long as I could.
That was big money back then.
It was big money, yeah.
Was that a union job?
I don't think so. No, he was a non-union shop, but he was a worker owner, and he taught me the trade, which eventually was building models when I was 15, 16, 18 years old. But that was sort of my introduction in the auto industry. And, then I've been serving professionally now for more than 40 years in the auto industry.
That's awesome. That's unreal.
Starting as an engineer up through general management. So
go back to these wooden patterns. Describe it a bit.
Wood dye models were the pattern or the simulation of the steel stamping or the plastic injection molded part on the car. So they were all made out of wood, typically mahogany, and the male shape was made by hand by craftsmen like my father. They were called model makers. And then we would take that male shape, we would layer it with a thin piece of, for example, wax to simulate the sheet metal stamping thickness, which back then was about a millimeter and a half or 60 thousandths of an inch. And, of course, cars got, thinner and thinner gauge. But then we would pour a plaster female mold, and we would deliver to the OEM the male and female. And those were used to actually cut the steel dies using what was called a true trace machine. So the true trace machine had a ball stylus and had a cutter, and it followed, if you will, the mold shape, and it cut the steel. And then that steel had the little bumps taken off by hand with a file by a die maker. And then that shape was ultimately heat-treated to be very hard and then put into the stamping presses to make the stamp parts, or in the case of injection molded parts, to have the plastic melted plastic shot in to make the molded part.
So going back that far and working like you did and getting an understanding, did that pay off for you later in your career, do you think?
Yeah, it did, because at the age of 14, I knew I wanted to be an engineer. I had interfaced with engineers at my father's business, so the OEM engineers were his customers calling on him, and I got to see how they handled themselves and the type of work they were doing. And so I knew at a young age, unlike a lot of young people, what I wanted to be when I grew up. So I went to engineering school. And then, of course, working for my father and his business, I learned, the work ethic. I learned the importance of customer satisfaction and quality, that if you focused on making a quality product on time and satisfying your customer, that you could, you know, enjoy a profitable business because, you know, customers will pay a slight premium for that level of service. And he was a recipient of that. He raised five of us kids, put us all through college, and had a couple of homes and two new cars every other year for him and my mother, who's still alive today. She's 91, actually. And, you know, it was a great family business.
So John mentioned that you're heading up TI Automotive here in the United States. What is TI Automotive?
So TI Automotive is a leading tier one supplier of automotive fluid handling components and systems. So we make anything that stores, carries, or pumps, if you will, the fluids that move around the car, which are your fuels, your fluids, your glycol, oils, vapors. And the company's 96 years old. We've been supplying all of the car manufacturers around the globe.
Okay, but it wasn't called TI Automotive then, right? What was it called?
Well, it was Bundy.
Bundy.
It was Bundy. So Harry Bundy started the company in 1922 in his garage in Detroit, Michigan, supplying Henry Ford fuel lines for the Model T.
I think I've probably told you this. My first job, summer factory job out of high school, was working at Bundy Tubing.
There you go. And that Bundy Weld, which was the trade name back then, which was the way he actually welded the two layers of steel together.
Seamless,
is not too much different than the process we use today, which is to take cold rolled, you know, steel that we mill to the desired thickness, and then we anneal it. We actually plate it with either copper plating or zinc plating and then cut it into strips. And those strips are rolled around one another, put through a continuous brazing oven, which then fuses those two layers of steel together. And we make that product for virtually many, many cars around the world that are on the underbody of the cars that most of us drive. So it's a very nice business, very global, very diversified geographically by customer, by vehicle segment. And I've had the pleasure now of going on 11 years being the leader of that company. So I'm honored to say I'm part of the TI Automotive team. Hmm.
So those tubes would be brake lines and things like that?
Sure. You have brake lines that run from your, you know, your master cylinder at the firewall all the way to your front brakes and then your rear brakes. So those are high-pressure hydraulic double-wall steel lines that, again, you don't see them, but they're critical to the function of the car. You have fuel lines, which are typically single-wall steel going from your fuel tank to your engine. In some cases, they're nylon. And then we also have a vapor return line, which is nylon, that takes all the unburned vapors from the engine, returns them to the engine to liquefy as part of the total capturing of the hydrocarbons and the fuel efficiency objectives of the car. We're also doing thermal products. So all of your cabin heating and cooling, as well as your engine cooling, which we are now adapting those thermal products to electric vehicles, which have to be cooled. In fact, the average electric vehicle has some three or four times the fluid handling content of a traditional internal combustion engine.
Why is that, Bill? Well, you know, I think batteries, and I think electrolyte.
Yeah, well,
I don't think of fluid.
Well, the batteries, when they get to a certain size for the range that we need as consumers, they have to be cooled. And the most effective cooling is liquid cooling. In fact, you even have, when the battery's in the rapid charging mode, you have to cool the battery, believe it or not, sitting in your garage or sitting at the charging station. So batteries have to be cooled. They also have to be heated. So if we're in a really cold temperature, like we get in Michigan here, you have to warm up that battery to be able to get the optimal life out of it. You have to cool the power electronics. You have to cool the electric drives. You no longer have the engine to provide heat to the passenger compartment, so now we have to heat the passenger compartment. Still using glycol, but typically with a glycol heater, if you will.
So you're not afraid of this move to EVs at all?
No, not at all. In fact, it's actually quite a positive for our company because there's more fluid handling content on electric vehicle than there is an internal combustion engine. And so we're pretty excited. We've been quite successful in the industry in the move towards electrification and securing some nice high-volume electric car wins for our future. And, yeah, we're excited.
But you're big in fuel tanks too, right?
We're making fuel tanks, right. Those are plastic blow mold fuel tanks, which will slowly phase out. Today, they're going by way of a pressurized tank. So hybrid vehicles require a pressurized tank. The tank, in essence, builds pressures while the vehicle's in the electric mode because the vapors that build up cannot escape through the engine, or in essence, they're not purged through the engine. So those vapors build pressure. and there's no space for the plastic fuel tank to expand physically in the car, and so we have to contain those vapors. So a lot of the initial hybrid vehicles that are on the road today went back to steel tanks. So steel tanks.
I didn't know this. Back to steel
to handle the pressure. Because there was no solution for a plastic blow-molded tank to handle the pressure. So we had this big move of, you know, away from steel starting around 1985, and most of the world is now plastic, except for some pockets in China, for example, and so forth, that's still converting to plastic. Then hybrids took them back to steel, albeit relatively low volume, and now TI Automotive has developed a pressurized plastic tank that is introduced on cars that are mild hybrids or plug-in hybrid electrics, and even some soon-to-be-launched cars where they'll contain as high as 500 bar of pressure.
That's a lot of pressure.
Which means the engine is off for a long period of time because the electric mode is on for an extended period of time. So that will be the optimum from a fuel efficiency because you'll have a very long range of electric mode before the engine kicks on for either recharging the battery or for, you know, a power requirement.
So this answers the question that I've been asking a lot of suppliers in town, because there's all these critics out there saying, oh, the traditional automotive supply chain, they're not ready for electrification. They're, you know, this is terrible. And every supplier I've talked and spoken with, just like you, they've already are well into electrification. The battery thing, I didn't think about, but that makes perfect sense for you. And then what, you're also moving into fuel cells as well?
Well, we have we also supply fuel lines for hydrogen fuel cell vehicles, for example, with Hyundai, who's you know, one of the leaders and came out first with their application there. And so we're flexible to go either way, right? I think the predominant high volume electric cars, battery electric vehicles, will be, you know, lithium ion as the power source. As we all read, the OEMs are investing, or the battery manufacturers are, billions of dollars in the capacity to produce lithium-ion cells. And so that will be the mainstay source for battery electric cars for, you know, the foreseeable future, right? Say, you know, 10, 15-plus years. There are other propulsion technologies that obviously are under development, hydrogen, for example, being one of them. But that brings out a whole different set of challenges. Just like electric cars have brought on a whole set of challenges with, you know, within the vehicle, the thermal requirements are talked about, but now you get into the infrastructure requirements, you get into the consumer acceptance part of it. So I think the next 10 years are going to be some of the most interesting years from a technology adaptation in the industry that I will have ever seen, in, you know, compared to the last 40 years.
So Bill, you've been in the industry for a long time. You've seen a lot of changes. Do you think that the change to electrification is going to be happening, or is this going to be something that will go a certain ways and then sort of peter out, and people will say the internal combustion engine's got so much that it can offer that it's not going to work out?
No, I think it's going to happen. I think it makes a lot of sense, but it will be a slow transition. So my personal view is that this will be a slow migration. I mean, I've watched some very advanced technologies in the auto sector take 20 years before they, from the first one to the time they're standard on the vehicle. And we're talking about technologies that are far less expensive than the investments that are being made in electric vehicles. And we're talking about technologies, for example, that are life-saving in from an active safety standpoint, which are very valuable from an advancement of, if you will, the automobile. So I think this will happen. I often get asked the question, when do I think the last internal combustion engine will be produced? My speculation is probably sometime between 2040 and 2050. So that's quite a bit out there. And then, of course, you'll have this mixture of cars on the road for quite some time, just like as we move to autonomous, which has the opportunity to save lives, because most of the accidents that happen are because of driver error that theoretically goes away with autonomous vehicles. However, you'll have this mixture of these new autonomous vehicles on the road starting around 2025 for probably several decades before the, you know, I'll call it today's car, wears out and the car park is now completely all autonomous. So that will bring on some unique implications on the roads with, having this mixture of vehicles. Some will be smart and connected, and others won't be, right? But there will be a day that some of us old dinosaurs like me will be told I can no longer drive my internal combustion car on the road any longer as part of the new rules. It's probably after my time, but, certainly my children will have to face that.
And speaking of those cars, you got some pretty cool cars. I mean, you're a total gearhead, right? You're not just a corporate executive.
Yeah.
You are into automobiles.
I love cars. I always have. Getting that young start in life, I was around cars and parts of cars. And I always told myself when I got older and I made enough money that I was going to, start, buying fun cars. And that started when I was around, 42 years old. So, yeah, I've been collecting cars for some time now, and I love sports cars. And
here we got a picture of you. Is this your M1 garage? That's,
yeah, so I have two garages, M1. That happens to be the garage I have the, I'll call it the race or the track cars in. So there's seven cars in there that are predominantly for the track and for enjoyment by
myself. So let me guess, that blue one at the top right hand, that's a 458 Ferrari?
That's a 458 Ferrari. Then next to it up in the top center is a Mercedes SLS AMG coupe. That's a Gullwing. That's actually one of my favorite cars. It's a very wonderful car on the track. Then up on the hoist in yellow is a Z06 Corvette C7R. So General Motors made only 500 of those cars in 2016, and that was it's a very track-oriented car. Below, it's a Viper. It's kind of decked out to match the Viper that won the Rolex 500 24-hour race in 2015 that T Automotive was a sponsor of.
That's at Le Mans, right?
No, that was outside of Orlando there. Where is it?
Sebring.
No, not Sebring.
Oh, Daytona.
Daytona 500, yeah, Rolex. And then what I'm touching there is a 911 GT3, a Porsche. That's the track version of the 911. That's a great car on the track. It's a nice cross-section. What you don't see is a Ford GT 350R, which is a great track car. I have a nice sampling of cars from, the traditional Detroit manufacturers, but then also certainly have an appreciation for the European-produced sports cars that are a lot of fun. But, yeah, so that's probably one of my favorite hobbies, is to be able to go on the track and enjoy those cars. And, as an engineer, what goes into the design and manufacture of these cars and then be able to experience it, at higher than normal speeds, because on the track there's no speed limit, and on the M1 track you can easily get up to 140 miles an hour on a straightaway.
And that's a pretty tight track, so you're really honking when you get up to that speed.
Yeah, you got to be a very experienced driver, and of course I like to go out there with only other experienced drivers as well. But it's something I enjoy doing in the nice weather as a fun sport. So. M1's a great venue for that. The other garage, I have a few more collector-type cars, and, I just enjoy having access to these cars and enjoying these cars as part of my love for the automobile.
So one garage you race and one garage you keep?
Correct. It's just kind of like a museum.
Okay.
Do you need to explain what M1 is to your...
I think most of them know. It's one of these sort of private clubs with a racetrack that are all over the country now, but there's one in the Detroit area that looks like it's been a resounding success.
It has.
I was up there a month ago or so, and they're building even more garages there, and I guess they're going to put in a big retail outlet, restaurant, that too. So
they sell them as fast as they can build them. So I think they're now entering phase four.
We got some video of like a track day at
that
one concourse.
That is, that's right. That was that's probably a cars and coffee event or a track day where people can show up on a Saturday morning and showcase your car and have a cup of coffee. And you're around other car enthusiasts that love cars, and so these gatherings are wonderful social events for you and your friends, and they have them in the summer most Saturday mornings. And, everyone's pride and joy is something different. So you'll see just a wide range of vehicles out there that we each identify with. But, M1 is a wildly successful venue. Unlike a lot of car condominium complexes, it has the performance track, 1.65 miles, And you can only become a member of the TRAG if you own a garage, so you don't have to worry about it being overcrowded with people who are buying TRAG memberships.
Terrific, yeah.
They have to first own a garage.
The other thing that's good about the M1, most of these other car club, country club things are out in the middle of nowhere. Right. This one's very accessible.
Right.
It's right in town.
Yep, it's a great location. So that, I think it's an 80-acre facility. It used to be a General Motors truck facility.
Yeah.
And they acquired the property, the entrepreneur, the CEO and the founder, Brad Olshansky,
mm-hmm.
Who's done a wonderful job of fully building out his vision so far. And, yeah, we love it there. It's a great venue, and I think that the demand far exceeds the supply of something like that in the greater Detroit area. So I'm glad I got in there early. I'm glad I got,
yeah.
I snatched up two of them.
Oh, man. Well, it's I remember when he was first floating the idea, and I thought, it sounds cool, but I don't know if it'll fly. And, man, it has
flown.
It's awesome.
Feel is that it was going to be successful because, you know, this is a car town. There's a lot of people with a lot of cool cars. It's not just Detroit muscle cars.
Right.
It's everything under the
yep.
sun.
Yeah.
And my gut feel is it was going to do pretty good.
Yeah. I think the metric is something like in the greater Detroit area, there are 50,000, you know, classic cars and sports cars squirreled away in garages and warehouses and foxholes that many of us collectors hate to keep your car in a rental unit, you know, because you don't have room in your home garage. So having a venue where you can really keep your car in style in a garage, the interiors of these garages you finish off yourself, and you see everything from full kitchens to golf simulators inside to jacuzzis, and everyone has a way to express their own personal style when you visit the interior of their
yeah.
garages. So they actually have garage crawls, which are nights where it's owners only, and you roll up the garage door and you go from garage to garage and showcase to your neighbors what you've done to finish off the inside. So it's really a nice venue. And what's nice about it is it's a family-oriented venue. So you have a lot of wives or spouses involved with this, as well as, you know, I'll say adult children, not young kids, but adult children who enjoy it as well.
Okay, we got a question here from Mark K. He wants to know, how much is a garage?
Well, I think when the garages first came out, they were for a moderate-sized garage, about $125,000. I think the most recent ones that sold, which are two-story, including a rooftop view, were somewhere around $600,000.
Mm-hmm.
So prices have actually crept up, I think.
And they're sold out,
yeah. And, you know, the turnover is very little. If one comes up, it goes very fast, and it goes for a premium price compared to what the original owner paid for it. So,
mm-hmm. Hey, we got to take a quick commercial break. Usually we devote the first half of the show to our guest. You want to hang around for the second half of the show, or do you got to go?
Sure. No,
cool. Okay. We'll be back talking more with Bill. We'll be talking more of what's going on in the auto industry. First, a shout out to our good friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking all things automotive, and this is the part of the program where Dr.
Okay,
Data.
Do this.
So we got to explain to Bill what this is all about.
All right, so we'll put some numbers you'll see on the screen, and this will be very self-explanatory, but this was in keeping with the holiday. So this is a holiday theme, and it has to do with the auto industry. So Katie, please bring up the first item. Okay, so which state has the least joyous drivers with 11.6 aggressive incidents during the holiday season? Okay, so this is not 11.6 incidents over the year. This is just during the holidays. So are the most aggressive incidents happening in California, Georgia, Louisiana, South Carolina, or Texas?
I vote for California.
California?
Well, California is the biggest state, so you might have the most there. That's a good guess.
But the gridlock is so horrible. I mean, I don't know. That's where I would think it'd be.
Uh-huh. So I'm going to guess that you know, this is during the holiday season. So this is going to be people who are the most stressed during the holidays. California seems to me to be laid back. They're not going to be as worried. So I'm going to guess, because we've got to, South Carolina.
Take a shot.
I think maybe Georgia. I agree it's not California, but this would not be typically a question that I would find myself being very good at.
And every week, none of us are any good at any of these things, and that's why they're found, and you'll be surprised. So bring up the answer. It's Georgia. You were right.
Yeah, Georgia's an interesting state. If you ever go there, or starting around now, if they get a little bit of precipitation that's frozen,
good point.
It shuts down. I mean, I've been stranded in Atlanta trying to fly somewhere multiple times in my career, so... it's a tough place.
All right, and traffic in Atlanta can be as bad or worse as anything in California.
All right, so John, you mentioned California being mellow. So here's the breakdown for the rest.
California's the second most stressed out.
Yeah,
well, I was almost right.
You were so close. You were only 0.3 off.
Yeah. And they don't even get snow. Yeah.
So there we have the rest of the numbers there. But for the total mellowness, just take a look at this number. So we. 4.3 aggressive driving maneuvers per driver in Hawaii. So they're just completely...
Well, I don't know how they measure this.
Completely mellow.
Yeah, good question. They're measuring these
police
aggressive driving.
I don't know.
So there you have it.
Okay, Gary.
So this means during the holiday season, guys?
Chill.
Drive chill.
Yeah.
Chill.
Just pretend you're in Hawaii. It's hard, I know, but just pretend.
That's a very interesting metric when you talk about the holidays, because General Motors recently shared a metric that during the holidays, distracted driving is increased by 34%.
Oh, yeah, I believe that.
You know, and if you think about it, I think it's very logical that that would go up during this time of the year, right? People are thinking of a lot of other things and
what they got to get off the your body off the shopping list. Get that done, right?
Yeah, so you got to be mellow and focused, right? Don't worry about your in-laws coming to town and everything, you know.
That's right. So this is the AutoLine After Hours tip for everyone.
That's right. We're doing our part to save the planet.
That's right. Be mellow. Drive carefully. Yeah. Don't be distracted. All right, so this is the end of the year. This is the last show we're going to do for this year.
Right.
Okay. So I thought that we should talk about what happened this year. And so I went back and looked over the last 12 months of what happened in the industry. And I'll tell you, one of the things that really surprised me was that on January 12th, General Motors unveiled the Cruise AV, the car with no steering wheel, with no pedals. And, you know, and I sort of got to thinking that, well, let's, you know, what else did General Motors do in 2018? And I was very surprised that, I mean, they launched the 2019 Silverado, right? And they launched the GMC Sierra, which is the...
Sister truck.
And they did the XT4 Cadillac crossover compact. That was it. And it almost struck me that in many ways that what is defining General Motors as of 2018 is autonomy.
Yeah.
What do you guys think?
Well, I think that's what they'd like it to be.
Well, look, here we got a picture of the car up there. This is a historic car. I mean, this is the first fully autonomous car from a major automaker with no steering wheel or pedals or anything like that. That's going in the history books.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it turns out that it works or not, whether they're able to turn Cruise into a viable business, doesn't matter in the sense that this is still going to be in the history books.
Well, it shows Wall Street that it's a company really thinking about the future, too, which... probably hasn't paid off in the stock price, but I mean, I think they're positioning themselves well. I mean, what do you think, Bill?
Yeah, I agree. You know, if you think back to when we were kids, General Motors were really leaders in safety, right? I'm talking, you know, 40, 50 years ago. And then, you know, with all due respect to General Motors, they kind of lost their way here. And other OEMs had emerged as safety leaders, like Mercedes, for example. And I think now what you see, and I'm really happy to see it because my first car was at General Motors, and second car, and third car, and fourth car, because my father drove General Motors cars, is now a reemergence of GM's commitment to safety, and I think it's wonderful. And, you know, when you think about autonomous vehicles, they are and will be more safe than your standard car because we remove this 95% of the time. Why the car gets in an accident is because of driver error, and 55% is because we leave our lane. And, you know, when these autonomous cars are performing like they are intended to be, and I believe they will be introduced at the right time and be robust, they won't leave their lane when there's another car either side of them, or they will stop automatically on time, right? And so, and they can see around curves, and they can see over hills and everything. So I think it's wonderful that General Motors is moving in that direction, and I think they will be very successful.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that, because some others are saying, hey, there's no data that proves autonomous cars are safer. And I counter by saying, yeah, well, guess what? 10,000 of the 40,000 fatalities we get a year are drunk drivers.
Yeah.
Autonomous cars are not going to get drunk.
Yeah.
There's at least another 10,000 and maybe even more that are from cars running red lights at intersections and T-boning somebody or getting T-boned.
Excessive speed. I mean, you can name
it. But what
I'm
saying is autonomous cars are not going to run red lights. So right off the bat, there's 20,000 lives saved.
Right,
you know, I don't care if there's no data to suggest to prove it. We know it's going to happen.
Yeah. You know, discussion we had not too long ago with a industry group was the fact that you have all of this active safety and passive safety technology in cars today to protect you from first getting in a crash, and then if you get in a crash, from, you know, getting injured. And with autonomous vehicles, you will be able to long-term take cost out of the car and decontent those active and passive safety features to some extent. It'll take a while because you have this mixture, as I mentioned earlier in the show, about smart cars and traditional cars on the road. But that will help offset the additional costs for, you know, the hardware and software that autonomous cars and the sensors will require as we're able to take off that then in the future unnecessary, you know, passive safety technology.
Mm-hmm. Drew, you're mentioning Wall Street, and so it was also interesting is that in May, SoftBank Vision Fund invested $2.25 billion in GM Cruise, which automatically drove up the valuation of that company to $11.5 billion. And then in October, Honda kicked in another $2.25 billion into this thing. So, you know, it's sort of like old auto doesn't really get that sort of investment from venture capitalist funds. And then we saw the president of General Motors, Dan Amen, being named the CEO of GM Cruise Automation, who will be starting in that position next week, week after, January 1st. Right. So, you know, in Dan Amen being a financial guy, essentially, right, John? I mean,
it's look, those two investments you just cited, to me, maybe some of the biggest news in this industry for 2018. Mm-hmm. We've never seen an investment group invest in General Motors. We've never seen a competitor like Honda invest in General Motors. GM and Honda have collaborated on engines where GM bought Honda engines, and they're collaborating on fuel cells. It's totally different when a Honda pours a couple of billion bucks into GM. And to me, this is going to be one of the models for the traditional auto industry to move forward, where everyone's saying, where do we come up with the money for all this electrification, mobility, connectivity, autonomy? Well, here's one way that you do it. And to me, that was a significant move.
Yeah, yeah.
So to be our friends in Dearborn at Ford, they started off the year with the putting the diesel engine, the Powerstroke, into the F-150, which was a seemed to me to be big news. What do you think about that, Drew?
Oh, the new one? The light duty?
F-150.
Yeah. It's we just finished testing it. It's really a terrific engine. And I think in this application, it shows that diesels aren't dead. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, they can be, if the system's working correctly, they're as clean or cleaner than a gasoline engine. And we got, when our testing, I think we averaged about 25 miles per gallon, somewhere around there in a full-size pickup truck, and I think it's EPA rated at about 30 for the rear-wheel drive only. It's smooth as diesel I can recall. It's a terrific engine. Now, we'll see how well it does, you know, in the marketplace. But I think for a truck buyer, for a light truck, for a, you know,
Diesels are doing just fine in the truck market. They're dead everywhere else.
Right.
Pass cars, forget about it.
Yeah.
They're dying in Europe. But in American pickup trucks, sales are up.
And when you think about, of course, America loves pickup trucks, but they also love, you know, pickup truck buyers are very savvy that tow. And so if you've got, you know, a couple of snowmobiles or, you know, watercraft that you tow up and, you know, tow to the lake and back or do whatever, nothing beats a diesel there in terms of, of, you know, efficiency towing stuff. And so I think they've got a niche. I mean, Ford's got a great niche, and it's a really good engine.
So, John, you were talking about the money that companies are going to be getting to be able to afford this change to autonomy. And so this year we also saw things like Ford announcing that they would have a lower volume passenger car lineup in North America and that they would be increasing their number of crossovers and sport utilities. They would be decreasing the number of variations that you could get when you go out to buy a vehicle. So and, you know, there's a lot of changes happening that way. What's your take on what's going on in that regard?
Well, you know, to me, it's fascinating. And it's a global trend, not just in the U.S., where consumers are walking away from passenger sedans and going into crossovers, SUVs, and pickups. And like I said, it's a global trend, not just here. Even though there will be millions, I don't know the number off the top of my head. We'll probably, just in the U.S. market alone, sell 5 to 6 million passenger sedans this year in the U.S. But sales have dropped 800,000 units this year. It's a staggering number. And they dropped about that much the year before and the year before that, too. So it's all downhill from here. But what I would say is that what's a crossover? It's a passenger car with an SUV-style body on it. I would argue that we call them trucks because that's the industry convention. The consumer doesn't see these as trucks. They see them as their car. And in reality, with the way that technology is right now, a crossover gets maybe 1 or 2 miles per gallon less than its passenger sedan equivalent. So, come on, in all due respect, these are passenger cars. And look at what's happened over the years anyway. Convertibles have just about disappeared. You don't hear anybody gnashing their teeth over that. Two-door coupes, boy, try to find one on the road. They're very rare. Look at station wagons. Maybe they're making a bit of a comeback, but when we were kids, that was the dominant car. So body styles come and go, and right now, traditional three-box designs or even hatchback cars are not in favor with the public.
John, though, I got to tell you, we just Ward's Auto did a study of this on the car-based crossovers, and actually, with even if you've got the same powertrain layout platform and everything, they're 300 pounds heavier, something like that, and also with the taller silhouette and everything, the car that they're based on, the car platform that most crossovers are based on, we did a comparison study with that, they get about 6 or 7% better fuel economy.
The car is better than the crossovers?
Yeah. So it's actually...
differences, weight difference.
Yeah. So actually the fuel economy is... actually, it surprised us. The fuel economy of your various crossovers, like an Edge or an Equinox or whatever crossover you have, and you look at what it's based on, there's a pretty significant fuel economy penalty you're looking at.
Well, you said 6 or 7%, right?
Yeah.
That's a couple.
Okay.
Okay.
What did I say? All right. It's significant. Let me say that. I have to think if it's...
What do you think about this move?
Well, I think we've created it for ourselves. You're right about crossovers are basically an SUV platform built on a passenger car platform, right? And... It's great because it's really helped the OEMs with their global platforms to have common platform, but some are sedans, some are SUVs. But what I find very interesting on the very high end of the pickup trucks, which is the quarter ton, half ton, three quarter ton, is you have these vehicles today that are more fuel efficient via lower displacement engines. So V6 is very common now in these full size trucks.
Yeah.
Turbocharged, direct injected, right? They're lighter. Some of them are using lightweight materials, which that along with the suspension changes. So virtually all these trucks have independent front suspensions, optimized rear suspension. This truck now rides like the car of yesterday, and you have a lot of space, and they're fuel efficient, and they're quite affordable in general, and the cost of fuel is quite low in this country. So the average American consumer is attracted to these full-size SUVs and trucks, naturally because of the factors I just mentioned. Interesting dynamic, and I don't see it changing anytime soon. I really don't.
So anyway, it makes it harder for automakers to meet the CAFE standards. So.
I don't think it does at all. I think under the old CAFE rules it did, because you had to average your fleet. You had to average your cars, and you had to average your trucks, and then there was an average of them. And now you've got, 11 or 12 different footprints. And all you have to do is hit a given rate of improvement in that footprint.
Well, you can add four-wheel, you can add all-wheel drive, and that will help you because it's easier to hit those. But still, when you have so many cars being replaced by CUVs, it is making it harder for automakers to meet at least the original targets for 2025, and that's one of the reasons automakers are looking for some relief, though not as much relief as the president wants to.
They're going to solve that problem by making a high percentage of battery electric vehicles, which have zero emissions, which will skew that average down significantly. I mean, you have some OEMs that are out there saying in the year 2025 that 25% of their fleet will be battery electric vehicles. That's a big number.
Yeah.
That's a big number. Well,
if that happens.
Well, Ford,
I don't believe it for a second.
So Ford announced this past
year.
Ford announced this past year that they'll have 16 battery electric vehicles by 2022.
Yeah, and GM says 20. And if you add up what every single automaker claims they're going to have, it's like 120 plus BEVs hitting the showrooms in 2022. And that's why I say it's going to be a disaster for the industry.
Bill will be doing a lot of cooling. It'll be great for him.
I'm basing this completely on consumer acceptance.
Correct.
I just don't think the consumer is going to accept that many. You know, they're not going to run out and buy that many.
That's one of the challenges. And so, you know, if you look at a hybrid vehicle, which has the dual propulsion, obviously very expensive to produce compared to a BEV or an ICE, market prices are not going to be substantially higher for a hybrid, right? And you wonder, how long will hybrid vehicles last? Will there be one generation and a half? I personally don't think it will be much longer than that because of the cost to produce those. But those hybrids are a platform for us consumers to get comfortable with the battery electric propulsion system, the range challenges, the recharging by plugging it in regularly, right? Gives us some time to the infrastructures in place. And it'll be a bridge for us consumers between today's internal combustion engine and tomorrow's pure battery electric vehicle, which, you know, as I said earlier, I think will come. It will take some time. And there are a lot of obstacles along the way, consumer acceptance, infrastructure, you know, mass production, cost. You just think of how many, you know, gigafactories have to be, you know, produced to make lithium-ion batteries for, you know, a big slug of the 100 million cars produced a year around the world.
It's going to take
several
time.
Billion. It takes time and a lot of investment.
The question I have is obviously if fuel prices go up, this would really help a shift towards electrification. But is there any, I mean, the more people I talk to, they don't see fuel prices going up much.
It's $7 a gallon in Europe. How many EVs do they sell? Still a very small slice of the total at $7 a gallon. So that tells
change,
me.
But that could
it
change.
It could change,
right?
And it will change.
You know, the availability of electric vehicles in Europe is not so prominent today.
Totally agree.
It will take some time to.
And when I say that we're headed for a disaster, I'm saying in the 2022 timeframe, this industry will work its way through it, as it always works through disaster.
Absolutely.
It knows how to do it.
Yeah.
But I don't see EVs catching on in big numbers until 2028, 2030, that time frame.
For sure not in this country. I mean, you know, Europe is likely to be, you know, further ahead in a higher adoption rate than the United States. China, for example, is probably going to be the leading.
Oh, they are the leader.
Right? And will continue to be. So you're going to have different acceptance rates and you know, purchase rates of BEVs around the world, with China being on the, you know, the leading edge, for example, and North America probably being amongst the last because the fuel prices are low, right? And we love our big vehicles. They will be amongst the last to go to battery electric propulsion powertrains, let's face it, right? So there's just some basic, you know, dynamics that will make it a slower process here in this country.
Hey, we got to take a quick commercial break right now. We're getting questions from the audience, too. We ought to get to some of those. Gary, I know you've got more topics. But first, we got to get this message in from Bridgestone. Okay, we're back talking all things automotive. Gary, I know you got a few more things there.
All right, so I think we ought to, like, since we talked about General Motors and Ford, we can't leave the FCA out. I mean, this was, so what did they introduce this year? Oh, that's right, a pickup truck, the Ram 1500 pickup truck. So it was a big year for trucks, because then if we go back to Ford, you were driving the new Ranger last week.
All right.
And which will not be available officially until
next month.
But, you know, the big thing that happened to FCA this year, Sergio, was the passing of Sergio at the end of July. Did you know him, Bill?
I didn't know him that well. I knew, you know, many of his direct reports around the world. And he was a big loss to the industry. He was a very visionary CEO. And, you know, his sudden death was, I think, a shock to all of us, and as well as his team. But I do have to say that his successor with Mike Manley seems to be doing a wonderful job.
Mm-hmm.
Is off to a great start, and so we're all real happy for him. Mm-hmm. And while he has some pretty big shoes to fill, it seems as though he's well on his way.
Can you believe that FCA is on such a tear right now?
Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe how well they're doing. Now, that's a this snapshot in time, but I think if we went back to 2012, you know, when essentially, you know, Sergio was just taken over at that time, nobody would have predicted that FCA would be in as good a health right now. You know, last month they came
with... Which goes back to pickup trucks and crossovers, well, or Jeeps.
It does. But, you know, they were the first ones to say small cars were out of it.
Yeah, and that was strong leadership, where he made no apologies, just boom, they're not making money, we're out of there, you know?
Exactly right. So, I think he was a loss, but I've known Mike Manley a long time, and I think he's going to do pretty well at the company.
But they got great products. I mean, the new Dodge Ram is a great pickup truck. When it first came out, I was kind of lukewarm to the styling. It's really growing on me. I don't have one, but I have a lot of friends that drive them, and they love them. I mean, the new Wrangler is a wonderful vehicle. If you look at it, they kept the important traditional design features of
it. It looks
Wrangler.
Like a Wrangler.
Yeah, it looks like a Wrangler, but it's really, you know, the next level of optimization. Grand Cherokee, very successful platform, and... you know, I think it's very solid, and so they've got a great lineup, and they're...
And more to come.
That's right.
That's what's mind-blowing to me, is that we still haven't seen the Wagoneer or the Grand Wagoneer.
Yeah. Right.
And then they've got some electrics and hybrids coming, too. So, I mean, I'm just stunned at Jeep's growth. But, you know, last month, FCA came within 10,000 units of catching Ford and Toyota in the U.S. market. And I never would have predicted that.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, the new Ram is terrific. I mean, the interior is just fabulous in the vehicle. And it's also the technology's really, just really advanced and excellent. We tested it for our user experience, for our interiors and engines. I mean, they are doing a lot of advanced stuff with pickup trucks and creating really a luxury vehicle now, which is what an awful lot of pickups are, with, you know, average transaction price of like $45,000 or mm-hmm. whatever. I mean, people don't understand. I think a lot of people in the U.S. don't understand how popular pickups are and how profitable they are, yeah. You know.
So at the very beginning of the year at CES, This past year, Akio Toyoda went on stage at CES and said, quote, "It is my goal to transition Toyota from an automobile company to a mobility company, and the possibilities that we can build in my mind are endless." Okay, so here's Akio getting ahead of it and saying this is what he's planning on doing, and we, you know, started the year talking about, or started the section talking about General Motors and Cruise and their autonomous thing. Ford spun off their autonomous business in July, basically setting up a separate company. They bought the Michigan Central train station in Detroit, where they're going to put their autonomous people. So this whole theme, I mean, this year, 2018, I think is going to go down as the year that people are placing their bets on autonomy in a big way, a bigger way than they have in previous years. But the thing that really surprised me was when I look back, okay, so we saw how General Motors introduced a new Cadillac, and they introduced the new Silverado and Sierra, and we saw that Ford introduced the Ranger, which will not be coming. We saw that FCA did the Ram 1500. I was surprised when I looked back who introduced all the vehicles in 2018, and it was Toyota. There was a new Avalon, the Corolla hatch, which you love.
I did.
There's a new Lexus EX. There's a new Lexus UX compact crossover. There was a new RAV4. And they came out with a Prius all-wheel drive vehicle. And that just really, really surprises me that this is the company that is just putting out new product in a way that our traditional domestic competitors aren't doing.
See, next year Ford's going to have as many vehicles as he just listed there. But the key thing with Toyota is it does this almost every single year. You can set your watch to their product cycle, the cadence. It's unbelievable how they do it. So Ford's going to come out with a ton of product next year. And then it's going to go dark for another 3 or 4 years. Now, I shouldn't say dark, but, you know, they're going to have this big wave and then go into the trough for a few years. Whereas Toyota, kaboom, ba-boom, ba-boom, every single year they've got stuff out there.
How do they do it?
It's discipline, number one. They don't come out with a product, and then typically they don't come out with a product, and oh, it doesn't sell, they throw it away. No, they stick with it. They keep working with it. Having said that, even Toyota's admitted it's got too many niche products right now. It's going to get rid of some of them. But it's discipline in maintaining your funding for your product cycle in bad times as well as good.
Well, I think they've also been really innovative in you know, these standardized product architectures and things like that, where they can build so many vehicles off, you know, similar off of those hard points they set up or on structures and things. So, I mean, they're fast. I mean, they're able to create products really fast.
Yeah. And then in an industry that seems to be shutting plants down or unallocating them, as it were, Toyota and Mazda broke ground on a new factory in Huntsville, Alabama, that's supposed to come online in 2021 and have a capacity of 300,000 vehicles, which you're skeptical of.
They're going to come to regret building this plant, is my opinion. I mean, how many Corollas does Toyota think it's going to build in a segment that's shrinking like crazy? And Mazda, do they really need that much? Look, the only reason that plant will make sense is if Trump does come through with a 25% import tariff on cars. Then it will make sense. Shy of that, they're going to regret they ever built this plant. That's my opinion. I'm not going to ask you to comment on that, Bill.
Thank you.
They're probably customers of yours, so we're not going to get you in trouble on
Thank
that.
You.
Right. All right, and then we give a shout-out to Honda. So I thought it was very interesting that they showed the Passport, new crossover, at the LA show in November, and they went into production in December.
Well, that's Honda. You know, they keep their powder dry. They spring stuff on us at the last second. Us in the media, is. And so it's not like they went, hey, here's an idea, what do you guys think? And the next month it's running down the line. No, this has been years in the making.
And in June they came out with the Honda Insight, which is a hybrid vehicle that...
up for Car of the Year, North American Car of the Year.
And in May they came out with the Acura RDX, which is also for the
truck or utility of the year.
Yeah, so here's the small company, bing, 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 three vehicles.
Honda, I so admire Honda. They're not like any other big traditional car maker. They literally march to the beat of a different drummer.
And the thing that really surprised me was, so when I went back through the months of Honda, what they announced, that there are so many motorcycles and so many all-terrain vehicles that they're making. I mean, it's astonishing. I mean, because I don't pay any attention to that, but I mean, just like next one.
And wave runners and generators and even jets.
Yeah, it's crazy. But I should point out that Ford bought a scooter company this past year, and General Motors is coming out with bicycles, okay, which...
They only paid like $1 zillion for both of them, right?
Our friends in Detroit and Dearborn are getting it.
Okay, so you're asking about Honda. Yi Yang Chang wrote in to say, what do you guys think of GM and Honda? Are they going to pull a Ford and VW move? Meaning, you know, we're expecting Ford to announce some big collaboration, joint venture, whatever it's going to be with Volkswagen.
Well, they're already collaborating on fuel cells.
Mm-hmm. Right, fuel cells, batteries.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's...
They're buying into GM Cruise or bought into GM Cruise.
Yeah. So, I think there's a pretty big collaboration there.
See, but to your point, John, I mean, Honda strikes me as being a company that is, you know, onto its own. That, yeah, it'll work with people, but you know what? It's going to still do what it does. And
they're amazing. You know, they don't do fleet sales at all. Yeah. They're the only one in the business that doesn't do this. Why? Because fleets, cars don't have as much of a profit margin. But even more importantly, fleet cars come back into the market very quickly. You know, a daily rental company typically keeps a car 6 to 8 months. As soon as it hits 30,000 miles, boom, it's back in the market, which hurts residuals. Well, one of the reasons that Hondas do so well is their resale value is through the roof compared to everybody else. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of discipline. And, you know, when Ridgeline sales, they're not going all that great. I mean, they're selling them, but they're not growing. They didn't discount them at all. No, they slow down the line speed. They don't make as many. And one of the reasons they can do that is the plant that builds the Ridgeline builds three other vehicles. So they can flex their production to whichever way sales go.
Yeah.
Nobody else has that level of flexibility. Others are flexible, but not to the level Honda is. And that's why I say they're a very different car company.
But I think being very conservative as well, it's worked out in the past, but I think in terms of autonomy and electrification, they were getting behind, so that's where I think they saw that they needed to partner with somebody to sort of make sure that they're current with all the mm-hmm. new technologies.
You know, it goes back to FCA. I mean, they really don't have a whole lot
right.
in that area. I mean, that Waymo is using the Pacifica hybrid.
Right.
But whose technology is that?
So, but I mean, I remember Marchione talking about that, and he said, look, you know, a lot of companies don't have the billions to spend on this, so we're going to, you know, have somebody else do it for us or partner up. And I mean... And again, I think that was a smart strategy for FCA.
It is. Hey, Gary, we got a question from the audience for you. Mark K says, we need a Tesla and EV report.
I don't know what that exactly means, but I do have some sales numbers here.
You talked about GM, Ford, FCA, Honda, Toyota.
Oh, so what Tesla's doing?
They built a bunch of Model 3s.
I guess the big news is they built a tunnel that was 1.1 miles in Hawthorne, California, that Elon thinks will be the way to transport their Model 3s through the area. You know, we had Henry Payne on the show.
With his Model 3.
With talking about his Model 3 and with his Model 3.
I don't know if you saw, but... Was it Inside EVs did a story about the show?
Yeah,
and Elon even tweeted out. In fact, we got
there
the tweet
go,
up
the
here.
Elon tweet.
So he's not tweeting about our show, but he's tweeting about a report about our show. So I think that's pretty good.
All right. So basically for people who are either listening to this or don't get what this means. So Elon Musk tweets out, love that people are buying a Tesla for the product itself, even if they don't believe in climate change. Not everyone can be convinced about global warming. But if electric cars is simply the best product, they don't need to be. So Henry Payne, who is the auto reviewer for the Detroit News, who was on the show a couple weeks ago, he basically is not an environmentalist
yeah.
in any way, shape, or form. I mean, when the Volkswagen diesel story broke, we had Henry sitting right there on the show, and he was arguing, it shouldn't matter
those cars are fun to drive. They should be allowed to exist, sort of thing. So when he was talking about his Model 3, he basically made the point he just loved the car. He took it to M1 and drove the piss out of it and just thought it was a great thing. And so that's what Elon was referring to. So
this is one thing that really bugs me about, because when you have people tracking EV sales, they say, oh, look, EV sales are really going up. That means everybody wants to buy an electric car. Well, Tesla now is about 70% of all EV sales. And a lot of people buying Teslas are buying Teslas because they're a great brand, they're cool, whatever. But that doesn't mean that everybody else making, you know, everybody else trying to sell an electric car, they're going to sell it, you know?
Hey, we're getting down towards the end of the show. We got a couple of phone calls here. Why don't we bring them in? Maybe we'll wrap up on that. Carmen, let's bring in the first phone call.
Hello, this is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. With this big push towards electric cars to help the environment, what about all the emissions that are going to be put out by the power plants, whether they're natural gas, to charge all these vehicles? Normally at night, the power generation goes down, but now everybody's going to be charging their cars, so we're going to be putting more pollution from the power plants into the atmosphere. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Clem. Appreciate that. I'll jump in, and then you guys can weigh in too, but even if you're burning coal to run an electric car, it's going to be somewhat cleaner than just burning gasoline. And I'm talking mainly from a CO2 standpoint. That's why we're going to electric cars. I mean, for all the other emissions, cars today running on gasoline are unbelievably clean. In fact, you know, if you have a PZEV car running on gasoline, you can close your garage doors, put the car in the garage, close the garage doors, start the engine, and it's not going to kill you.
Don't try it at home. This is not to be advised.
But go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, okay. So here's, you know, one of the things that electric cars offer you the opportunity to do is to charge at night when the power is not being demanded by air conditioners and you know, heaters and whatnot. And it's very clever the way that you just program that into a cell phone or on a screen. And so I think that you're not going to have this problem of people not taking advantage of the lower rates at night. And so, Clem, I don't think that we're going to have a whole lot of wasted grid that will not be used by these cars.
But, and I think to his other question, though, about increased pollution, I don't think that is, I mean, there's electric EVs are inherently more efficient, right, in the way to your point. And from the folks we've spoken with, I think, in the power industry and whatnot, it ultimately is more efficient and clean and cleaner.
Yeah, well, I mean, we can debate all this, too, but we've got another phone call. And, Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hi, John. This is Dale Leonard out of Cleveland, Ohio. Yeah, I'm glad to see Lincoln returning to their heritage with names instead of the alphanumeric, especially the return of the Continental name, and now with the suicide door option. Well, last weekend I ran into a gentleman with a brand new Continental, and, you know, he bucked a European black wall look and installed white walls, and it enhanced the whole appearance of the car. I'd like everybody's opinion. You think Lincoln should go full-blown heritage and go back to white walls on their high-end vehicles? Great show as always, and Merry Christmas and Happy New Year to the whole Autoline organization. Bye-bye.
Thanks for that, Dale. We really appreciate it. Yeah. Bill, what do you think? The names, white walls?
Well, I used to be a lover of white-letter tires and white-wall tires. I'm not so sure about whether that should be the new standard. I have my nuts. I'm slowly growing to black wheels and dark wheels, where I've been a polished chrome wheel guy.
Really? I don't like black wheels.
Yeah, well, they're slowly growing them, probably because you don't see the brake dust as much,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
And
is this for your racing sort of, I mean, where it comes from?
Could be. But yeah, I'm not so sure about white walls.
So, Gary, what do you think? White walls and names instead of...
Well, I mean, I think that, yeah, I mean, the name thing is nice. I mean, but it doesn't seem to be doing all that well for Lincoln. I mean,
don't judge. Yeah, I know what you're going to say. I'd say don't judge it yet.
Judge what yet?
Well, I mean, if you look at Lincoln sales, they're nothing to write home about. Is that what you're going to say?
Well, I was going to say basically, yeah. I mean, and so, you know, the Continental with the suicide doors, I mean, basically they announced that they're going to make 80 for the 2019 model year, and they're going to make a limited, undefined number the following year in 2020. I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of suicide doors coming from Lincoln or from anybody else for that matter.
Okay, first of all, don't say suicide doors. Say coach doors or whatever,
sorry.
Because they are, you know. But I think it certainly is a PR move. I think it's been great because people are talking about Lincoln now.
I mean, at least for a while. It was headlines around the world. Yeah, it was a brilliant move.
It got Lincoln talked about. So right. We'll see what happens. But I think the naming is better because the nomenclature they had on there, I couldn't tell you different Lincoln.
So you didn't think the MKS was a good name?
Yeah, no.
I missed the question on the name. I am a big fan of having names for these cars. I am not a big fan of the alphanumeric code for cars. I think that is you lose some of the personality of the car when you do that. So I really wondered why Cadillac did that. But, okay, I'm sure they have their reasons. But many did it before and many have followed since, right?
Yeah. I'll make a prediction. I'll predict that Cadillac's going to drop the alphanumeric slowly as new models get introduced.
No.
And you don't think so, right?
No.
Okay.
They're going to be introducing XT4?
XT6.
No, they did XT6. I think they're going to come out with the XT4, or is it vice versa?
Whatever.
Anyway, I'm just saying they're coming. Yeah,
but I want to respond to Dale directly. I think you're onto something with the white wall tires. I would not do it across the board. I would not even make it across the board on one model, but I would make it optional. And I'd especially make it optional on the Continental, because I think you're right. I think there's a look there that it could absolutely work. Not going to be for everybody. In fact, it might be fairly small. But what a cheap way, inexpensive way. I don't want to say that this is cheap.
Yeah.
What an inexpensive way to create a totally different look than what anybody else has got on the market.
Yeah.
I think it's a good suggestion.
Well,
dead silence.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
A surrogate for white wall tires is some OEMs have put a stripe on the rim of the wheel.
Mm-hmm.
And that adds a nice touch. So, for example, Chevrolet with the Corvette has offered either in yellow or red.
Right. And that red stripe pops.
Yeah.
Right.
And it does pop. But, you know, depending on the cars, I think that is a nice feature to bring back some of that throwback and having some beauty. And wheels have become a much more important part of the car's appeal. Let's face it, wheels used to be a hubcap on top of a steel base wheel,
mm-hmm.
and that no longer exists today for most cars, right? So a lot of effort goes into the styling of wheels, the size of wheels, and the width of wheels. And so I have an appreciation for the wheels on the cars.
There's a place in Detroit called Mob Steel. You ever hear of these guys?
No.
They make custom steel wheels.
Yeah.
These are not mags. They're not aluminum alloy. No, they're steel wheels. They look fantastic on the right car. And a Continental is one of those cars. But that's what got me thinking, wait a minute, there's still stuff that you can do from a somewhat retro standpoint.
I mean, fuzzy dice steel option.
No, I'm not going with that. There's been a lot of great stuff over the years, and then something new comes and we all go after that, and then we forget where we came from or what's been done in the past. I'm telling you, Mob Steel has got some steel wheels that I think on the right luxury cars looks absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, the only thing I want the listeners to be aware of is when you change the weight of that wheel from aluminum to steel, you know, that wheel is what we call unsprung mass.
Yeah,
the riding handling characteristics of the car.
Katie and Carmen are amazing.
Go.
So
that's a beautiful car.
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
Those are steel wheels.
Yeah. But
okay,
you're changing the riding handling characteristics
you are.
Significantly if you go from a lightweight aluminum, and some cars even have carbon fiber wheels now, to a steel wheel.
No, you're
right.
I think it's
steel wheels.
You're right. But, you know, we're running into that problem anyway as people put on 20-inch, 21-inch, 22-inch. In fact, I saw at L.A. the BMW iNext, I think it was a 24-inch wheel. Now, that's a concept, but
right.
but they don't ride and handle as well as cars with smaller wheels.
Well, when you see people with the aftermarket wheels, they don't, you know, clearly they're just, they want to look. They're not concerned about
that's right.
handling.
Anything else.
Yeah, anything else, really.
Hey, look, spinners were pretty popular yeah, right, a decade
yeah.
ago.
Yeah. yeah.
Undercar lighting.
John Manoogian, designer, writes in, white walls? Seriously? I knew the designers would hate it. You guys hated the roof caps. You hated the gold trim. And gold look package. How much money people made selling those things. I'm not saying that I was in favor of those yeah. either, John. But at the end of the day, it's about making money.
I would be surprised if they made money off of white walls now.
I think the tire manufacturers have thrown all that tooling out.
If it was offered by an OEM, I mean, wouldn't they have to certify the tire to the
Absolutely.
The car?
Well, so, sure, yeah.
So that white wall would end up costing them money.
We got to get somebody in who knows tires in here. And they.
Yeah. I'm still think that
it's a unique variant.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, and given the fact that, as I was going to point out, that you didn't want me to point out, that they sold 7,600 Lincoln Continentals so far this year. Not so good.
Oh, no. That car, in fact, some of the analyst groups have already said it's going out of production in another year or two.
I mean, it's a gorgeous car. It's a well-done car.
It's a car. That's a problem. But look at the Navigator in the Expedition, though.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think the average transaction price on the Navigator is like $90,000. So, I mean, you know they're making a ton of money from
those. But people still buy cars. I think we dismiss cars too easily and say, nobody's going to buy a car. No, I don't think that.
They're
going down, but people who are making good cars are still selling good cars.
I think the people that are the automakers that are doing well, that have historically strong buyer base, Honda Accord, Toyota Camry, some of those, they are doing well, where the lesser sort of the next tier sedans,
right.
they aren't doing well at all. But even there, if you look at Camry and Accord sales, they're way down.
They're down, but they still sell over 300,000 units.
That's
and
right.
so
that's
nothing to...
Or you look at Civic sales. I mean, Civic is still doing pretty... But they kind of own that segment, you know. The Cruze was not a big... It's not a big factor in that segment, so, you know, they're letting it go.
Well, look, we're going to debate this to death, but we're not going to subject our audience to listen to us do that.
They'd love to.
I think
we've
got to wrap this show up right now. Bill Kazira, thanks so much for coming on. Last show of the year, man. It was just awesome having you here.
Thank you very much.
Really good.
Thank you.
Great story.
Great to be
Drew
here.
Winter, great having you on board, as always.
Fun.
And Gary, we're not going to be here next week.
That's right.
We're off for the Christmas holidays. We'll be back first Thursday in January.
January 3rd.
Sandy Monroe will be in the house. So I'm sure we're going to be talking a lot of Tesla stuff
right.
and other things.
The insides of Tesla, the inside and out.
Right. So anyway, I want to thank all of you for having tuned in. Thanks for sticking with us through the year. Have a great holiday season, and we'll see you in the new year.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.